Good morning. My name is Frank Dravis, and you are listening to WDRT Conversations, 91.9 FM in Viroqua. Today, my guests are Becky Brockman and Linda Olson from the La Crosse Area Beekeepers. And in the spirit of a full disclosure, I am a member of that organization. But there's always things I want to know about beekeeping, and so I'm really looking forward to this conversation. How are you doing, Becky?
Great. How about you, Frank?
I'm doing well. Looking forward to a beautiful morning here in Viroqua, mid-April. How are you doing, Linda?
I'm doing great. Great.
Excellent.
The nice sunshine has been really wonderful.
So who or what is the La Crosse Area Beekeepers?
Okay. The La Crosse Area Beekeepers was started by a group of gentlemen in the early 70s, and their goal was to educate people on beekeeping and bees in general. And we've worked to keep that alive. We actually just lost one of our founding members. He was 98 years old, Bob Hoffman. And he remained active in beekeeping until he did pass away. But to fast forward it, COVID did take a little hit on our group, and it took a little bit to get the organization up and running again. So we've had a great group of our executive committee that has worked very hard to get us up and running, get the club going again, and try to come up with some new and more innovative things to get people interested in beekeeping.
Now, the title of the organization is La Crosse Area, but where are your members from?
We have members from Winona, your Viroqua area, Stoddard. Sparta, Toma, there's some from Norwalk, Wilton. We've even had some from further away. So we're, it's a kind of a general. It's not La Crosse County or the immediate La Crosse area. I mean, if somebody's willing to drive, we'll welcome them in our organization.
I know we've had conversations in the past about attendance to our Facebook page. We have two of them, one for the close-knit community, and then one because the more public-facing, because we get people from all over the U.S. who want to join our group.
We do.
Yeah.
And as the person who I handle most of the communication, after COVID, we had just weakened down to about 5 members. We had no communication. If you wanted to find us, you couldn't find us. And we couldn't re-rise our website because we didn't know who had established it, so we just went to Facebook.
Mm.
What we're finding on Facebook is we're getting beekeepers, we're getting the public, we're getting the person that wants to buy honey, we're getting the person who has a swarm. We have a person who wants you to come and talk to their class. And because it's so accessible, it's really brought us to the front. And so now we have 65 paid members and a mailing list of at least 100.
Hmm. Interesting. So I was out walking the woods the other day, and I was seeing some crocus. Of course, in my wife's garden, there's crocus and daffodils, and I've been seeing the woodland violets. What are the honeybees foraging on today? I mean, it's middle of April. What are the bees foraging on?
Right now, more than likely, it's a tree pollen. I don't know that they get a lot from the crocuses. It's interesting. Every flower is more specific bees. I mean, a honeybee cannot get nectar from, say, like the crocus or a honeysuckle because, it's got that long petals there and they don't have the ability to get in there. So generally the gold standard for a honeybee is probably a dandelion because that's you know, pretty much when they start coming out, then you know there's going to be a lot more nectar coming in general.
So when they're feeding off of what trees, my wife and I were having this conversation yesterday about the different buds and flowers on trees. Specifically, what trees are they, would the honeybees be hitting now?
That one I'm not really sure. I know basswood trees are wonderful. Honeybees just love that particular tree. I think, what is it, maples are coming in now, and they are probably getting something off of that.
I know walnuts are blooming, but it'll be a while before they bud out. I'm sorry, I don't want to say walnuts. Maple trees. Maples. I tap maple trees, and yep. I've been watching yep. them bud out.
The serviceberry tree, a lot of people don't recognize, but they know when they see that big white tree out there, they're wondering, what is that? That's a serviceberry, and it's a wonderful tree for both bees and birds because it's a seasonal. It goes from budding, pollinating, and then serving berries at the end of the season. So, basswood for sure makes a strong honey flavor.
Mm. So black locust is another one I think that's pretty popular for honeybees.
Okay. So we have a booth at the La Crosse County Fair. We have a lot, when we put up our presentation at the La Crosse County Fair, we have a live hive there with the glass wall. But we also, you know, kind of tease the fairgoers with our questions and answers or with our quiz. And so I, in the spirit of that, I have our quiz, but I've modified it, right? So, because there are some interesting factoids on the quiz, and so we are going to play our own version of Stump the Experts. Some of these questions you will recognize because you two created them, but some of them I've modified. So, first one, how long does a honeybee that was hatched in June, okay, that's a specific caveat, hatched in June, how long does that honeybee live?
That honeybee is going to live 4 to 6 weeks. They are working their little hearts out for those 6 weeks. And with wind damage and the flying that they do, their wings get damaged. They, you know, like there's other parts of their body, like legs and things they could lose. They could run into a predator more readily. And 4 to 6 weeks is their lifespan.
So compare that to, or contrast that to, a honeybee. When would be the last honeybee in the season that would be hatched?
Depends a lot on the weather.
On average.
September, late September, early October.
For a honeybee that was hatched in late September, how long will that honeybee live?
That honeybee more than likely will, depending on a lot of factors, but ideally can live 4 to 6 months.
Okay, so there's a difference because that honeybee's got to get through winter.
Correct.
Because those honeybees aren't hatching no pupa or whatever in the middle of winter.
Correct.
Right, so in the summer they're busy bees. In the winter they're sleepy bees.
Well, they're not really sleepy. They're keeping their hive comfortable.
Right, so do honeybees hibernate?
Honeybees do not hibernate. That hive is constantly moving. In the summer, I know we're going winter, but in the summer, they work to keep the hive at like a 92, 95 degree temperature, and that's optimal temperature for brood raising. In the winter, we don't have that brood, so they will lower the temperature into around 60 degrees, 55, 60 degrees, and that's a temperature that they can survive at and not have to expend as much energy.
Wow.
To keep the hive alive.
So what bees do in the winter is called cluster. So what they do is they form a circle as they cluster, and there will be an outside ring of bees who will be the cold, getting the most cold, protecting the ones in the middle who are getting the warmth. And so as they get too chill, the cluster shifts and they trade places.
Hmm.
So the warm guys on, gals on the inside, there are no guys in there at this point. The gals will move to the outside and let the cold ones back in the inside.
So you answered, indirectly answered one of my next questions, and that was, what is the sex of the vast majority of honeybees in the hive? And they are?
Female.
Female.
Yeah. I was also going to add to that, when they're in this cluster, their wing muscles shiver to create more heat. They're not flapping their wings. They're just moving the muscles of their body to create that heat.
So it's amazing that a honeybee hive can survive minus 20, minus 25, minus 30 degrees. I mean, we don't see that often in Wisconsin anymore, but we did see minus 19 at my house this winter. You know, and that's impressive that a honeybee, you know, you walk out to the box, it's the hive, it's 1:30 in the morning because your dog had to go pee in the middle of the night, right? And you're freezing and the breath is steaming off your face and it's snowing and it's bitterly cold and you look at that hive box and you go, there's no way there's anything alive in there. But it's impressive that they're alive and, you know, someone's awake in there, you know, shivering to stay warm. So what is the purpose of the male honeybee?
The purpose of the male honeybee is only one thing, and that, okay, let's qualify that. One positive thing, okay?
One positive
thing?
We don't have a female bias going on.
Oh, we do.
No, picture the drone out at the gas station smoking a cigarette going, hey, babe, want to ride?
So when my wife calls her honeybees her girls, it's because they're all females. So, all right, so what's the purpose of the male honeybee? What's he...
The sole purpose of the drone is to hopefully mate with a virgin queen.
Okay. So why do they call them drones? I mean, come on, let's be a little bit more sexy about this. Why don't they call them Studley? Why do they call them a drone?
Because the girls named them.
That figures. Okay. All right, I know where this conversation's going. Okay, so how many times can a honeybee sting you?
The worker bee will sting one time because she has a barb on her stinger, and when she pulls away, it leaves a stinger in her body, so she will die after she stings. A drone has no stinger, and your queen bee has what they call a retractable stinger, so she can sting multiple times.
So this is comparing that to wasps, or hornets or yellow jackets that can sting multiple times. Why is it a female honeybee can only sting one time?
It's just really her anatomy. The way her barb is set in, the way that it sticks into us and then gets pulled out of her system so that it really tears her apart. So, and that's where honeybees get the bad rap, because they get put in that whole bee situation where they get blamed for what the wasp or the hornet's going to have a tendency to do, and that sting you more than once, or go after you for no reason whatsoever. So the honeybee, because they can only sting you once, is very reluctant to come after you for any reason other than threat. So if you accidentally put your hand down on a honeybee, it will sting you. It will die. If you accidentally put your hand down on a hornet, it's going to sting you and sting you and sting you, and it's going to fly away.
Uh-huh.
So...
satisfied.
Exactly. So that's a big difference there.
Because, there are many ground bees out there, different types. Mm-hmm. The specific type of ground bee that I have a problem with are German yellow jackets, and those things, they are, and if you're not educated, they look a lot like a honeybee.
That they do.
And so you've got to, but if you know a little bit about them, then you can see, oh, clearly that's a yellow jacket. And that thing on a scale of 1 to 5 is like a 5 for hostility, whereas a honeybee, you know, if bumblebees are on a scale of one, you know, very docile, honeybees are down near the bottom two, right? So how many honeybees live in a hive, typical, on average?
During the peak summertime, it's 660,000 to 80,000. 60,000 to 80,000. It can go anywhere from 30,000 to 80,000, depending on the season. When we release a package of bees, we'll be getting 3-pound packages in the spring now, and that will be about 10,000 to start her out. And then so as that queen gets going and laying eggs, it will start to generate more and more and more.
That is an impressive number, especially when you think about the mechanics of trying to fit 80. I always go by the simple number of 40,000, right? Mm-hmm. Even just 40,000, that's a big number to fit in a hive box. And so we can, later on, we can talk about the mechanics, the tactics and strategies of when to increase the size of your hive. And for the purposes of our communications, this show, what is the name of the types of hives that predominate in the La Crosse area beekeepers? What type of hive are they?
It's a Langstroth.
Langstroth.
Yep.
There's Leyen, I believe.
Leyen, yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess I don't keep track of a lot of them because I stick pretty much with the basic.
Right. The Langstroth is the most common type of hive. It's where you drive through the country and you see these boxes stacked up on top of each other.
Correct.
And that's a predominant hive type used by the commercial beekeepers.
Correct.
Right? Okay.
If there's any drawback to that type of hive is that it, as it gains honey and resources, it gets really heavy. So if you have a box on a box on a box, you could be lifting 100 pounds off the top box to check the bottom box, where the Leyen hive is a more of a horizontal hive, where you're going side to side instead of top to bottom.
Right. It's very convenient in that way, but it's harder to expand beyond the size of its.
Correct.
The Langstroth is more modular.
Correct.
As long as you're willing to go vertical, like a high rise. Mm-hmm. Okay, so when harvesting honey, if you can, without dangerously depleting the resources of the hive, how many pounds of honey can you get in general?
There's so many variables that can go into that. You know, if you've got a good honey flow, they can fill a super, which is in general 10 frames of medium frames, which I don't remember the exact dimensions of.
8 inches.
But that box is going to weigh 50, 60 pounds. And if you've got a great honey flow or nectar flow and a strong colony, you can fill that in a week. I mean, so when you've got a good summer, you've got to keep your eye on that hive to make sure you give them enough room to keep building out. Otherwise, they're going to start doing their own thing.
So we'll get into that later. Let me make sure our listeners understand what a nectar or honey flow is. That, Becky, what is that?
So when everything is in bloom and it's rotating through, so like one flower will bloom, it'll drop off, and the next flower will start its peak production. The bees will go between the two, and as everything starts to light up, the dandelions, and people aren't killing, the dandelions are there, the goldenrod, whatever is shooting up now, that's going to be where those bees are going to be going. As we get into the summer, we get into what we call hot summer, and we call it a dearth, where these guys are not producing what the bees need right now. So there's variables in heat, moisture, things like that. So the nectar flow is really when everything is blooming and people are complaining about allergies and things like that. So it's the trees, it's the flowers, it's everything.
So hang on to that. Let me do a channel check. For our listeners, good morning. My name is Frank Dravis, and you are listening to WDRT Conversations 91.9 FM in Viroqua. And today my guests are Becky Brockman and Linda Olson from the La Crosse Area Beekeepers. So you have the nectar flow, and then inside the hive you have the honey flow, and I gather that's the process where the bees bring in the, once the nectar gets in the hive, the bees create the honey and start filling up the frames and capping the individual cells. Is that what you would call the honey flow?
Well, honey flow is really when it's being produced by flowers.
Okay.
They're picking up the nectar.
Gotcha. So 60 pounds in a healthy hive, that's an impressive amount of honey. So how much of that honey does one honeybee make?
So
in a season, how much does one honeybee make?
Look at this little bee. She starts out as a nurse bee and turns into a forager. 6 weeks later, she's done. In her whole lifetime, she only collects 1/12 of a teaspoon of honey. So another way to say that is if you want a teaspoon of honey, you need 12 honeybees to work their whole lives for one teaspoon of honey.
And if you consider how much honey is consumed in the United States in a year, that tells you something. So how many flowers does a honeybee make or touch per foraging trip?
It could be up to hundreds.
You had a definitive answer in one of your quizzes that I gave at the county fair.
We're going to change that question. We don't like the way it's worded. It's so hard to... I mean, there might... What's the answer, Frank?
12. It was either 12 or 85. I wasn't paying attention.
Sure,
I expected you guys
85.
To know.
We think it's 85.
I think 85 is closer because they
85.
Just go from flower to flower to flower, right. And they just get such a minute amount at each one.
So next question. True or false? Bearding is trimming of thorns from the Lord of the Rings beard.
That would be false.
So what is bearding?
Okay, bearding is seen many times when it's hot in the summer, or if you've got a very strong hive and it's their way of managing the temperature within the hive. If it's getting too warm, they will go outside of the hive and just kind of hang out on the outside and create different shapes.
It looks like beards.
And it looks like a beard.
Big, bushy beards.
And you may have seen a picture of someone who has taken bees and put them on their chin, and it looks like a beard. It takes a pretty steady hand to do something like that, but it does. It's the same thing where they're hanging on each other's legs. And there's also a phenomenon called washboarding, where you may go out to your hive, and the whole side of your hive is full of bees. It's hot out. But they're all facing the same direction, lined up facing the same direction, facing down, for example. And then as if some silent whistle is blown, all the bees slowly turn up. So now they're facing up, and that's called washboarding. And it's a phenomenon that if you're lucky enough to see it, you'll take pictures and videos because no one knows why they do it. But instead of bearding on top of each other where they stay too warm, these are single rows, singles, all hooked together by their feet.
Fascinating.
So if you ever get to see washboarding, it's something to look at.
I'll pay attention to that. It was last summer, and there was a stretch, I don't know, a week or so, where we didn't have any rain, and our hives bearded through the night. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of times the night cools off, and the bees will go back in the hive, but the side of the hive box was covered day and night, and I was worried, right?
It's dangerous for the bees to be out at night.
Right, and they didn't go back in. Fortunately, we're going to talk about predators. In the summer at that time, there were no predators, but I've had a recent experience that is a little bit different from that. On average, how far away will a honeybee go in a foraging trip? This is one of your questions.
Yep, it is.
Yeah.
In general, 2 miles. They will go up to 5 miles away. They need to. They can, that's a lot of flying.
They don't forage too close to home. So you think, well, I'm going to do my solid for my bees. I'm going to put a pollinator garden right out in front of the hive. They do not, they will not visit it because what the pollinator garden would do is pull in the robbers as well as them. So you don't put your water there. You don't put your flowers right there. So that half mile away is more comfortable for the bees.
Mm. And so when you're, if you're a beekeeper, it's good to be cognizant of what's out a half mile away because your bees are going to be visiting that territory, whether it's forest or cropland or urban or...
Or somebody's swimming pool.
Mm-hmm. Or
bird bath.
Bees love swimming pools and hot tubs. And we'll talk about water in a minute and how important that is to the bee, but there's an enzyme in that salty water. They like murky water. They're just drawn to it. And
really?
So the complaints we get are from people like, there's dead bees in my pool or there's dead bees in my hot tub.
They go there for something in the water.
They like it.
Well, let's talk about that in a bit. How does one bee tell the other bee where to go for flowers? I mean, it's not like they're going to tell them the GPS coordinates. How can they communicate to one another that, hey, there's a flower patch a half mile from here, and it's that direction, and you go north and hang a left here at the corner? How do they communicate?
By the big oak tree.
How do they tell each other where to go?
They have what they call a waggle dance, which the bee, she dances, and she kind of flutters back and forth and goes in a circle or go in a figure eight shape. And
a little bit of twerking.
And
wow. Thank you, Becky.
And point the direction or get their attention and, you know, that pretty much tells them what direction to be flying and potentially how far they have to go.
That's just amazing. It's amazing. I mean, they're communicating. They're speaking their own language. So there is, I mean, you've heard about the phrase hive mind. There is some sort of animal sentience at work here that, as you said, using the washboarding example, something's going on inside that collective psyche that, you know, communicates to them.
They also use the waggle dance as a new forager. So they sit on the landing board, they're ready to go on their first forage. Before they even go, they're going to fly up and they're going to do these eight figure eights around the hive to kind of acclimate themselves. And then as they leave that area, they're ready to go now, they almost back away so that they have a view of what it looks like to come back in.
Mm.
So that's something I've started doing in a hotel room so I know which way to turn left or right when I leave my room.
So, yeah. I'm for our hives, I'm the helper. My wife is the beekeeper. And Becky's cheering. So my wife, she likes to scold me when I stand in front of the hives. And she says, No, that's the flight pattern. You're in their
Flight path.
Yep. And whereas if you go to the side of the hive, you don't get pestered very much. And if you go behind the hive, you don't get pestered at all. But if you stand in front of the hive, the bees, and she said, if you stand back, you can watch and you can see where the bees are going. And there's a steady stream, the bees lifting off from the landing deck, I call it, by mm-hmm. the hive entrance, and they'll be going off into a specific direction and they'll be coming back in and out. And if you get out of the flight path, you can stand there and watch them. It's very therapeutic. I mean,
it is. It's amazing.
If you're into mindfulness and you want to relax, get out your lawn chair and just stand back about 15 feet or so and just watch them. You learn a lot.
In fact, it's the best way to judge the health of your hive because what you're going to see is you're going to see the bees leaving. You're going to see the number of bees coming. You're going to see the pollen on their pants. You're going to see if a hornet lands there and is able to get in past the guard bees. If that hornet isn't ejected immediately, then you've got to know that there's some weakness in the hive. So you watch that hive for everything.
Hmm, interesting. Beekeeping is not easy. And I can tell you this from experience, painful experience. Let's go over. Let's just think about the last 4 or 5 years. Given all of the members in our club and our association, what do you think is the average success rate in our beekeeping group? I mean, when we go to the meetings, there's 30 or 40 members that regularly attend our meetings, right?
Correct.
And there's a whole bunch that are active but sometimes come to the meetings and sometimes don't. And we always go around the room and we ask, you know, where are you from? How many hives do you have? And a lot of the answers are no hives. I've got dead outs. So overwintering, what do you think is the average success rate?
It may be 20% for our club. Like we've said before, there's so many variables that come into play with getting the hive ready for winter.
I think for, on average, for the U.S., at our latitude, that's about average. Because the...
Well, and sadly, last year, not this last winter, the winter before, the nationwide average was 60% loss, which was huge. It was a huge loss.
And we're talking very safe areas for bees like California, Georgia, Texas, where, you know, maybe the climate is a bit more friendly or for the honeybees. So what are some of the factors that contribute to hive outs, you know, loss of a hive?
Well, disease.
Okay.
Many people have heard of the mite issues these days, which mites came into our country in 1987 and have been a issue since then. Mite likes to live on the underside of the bees. They like the drones the best because they are reproduced within the capped pupae.
The mites are.
And one mite can produce up to 3 mites before a new bee emerges, and that's ideally in a drone, which thankfully that's a lower number of the population are the drones. But they carry so many viruses that can weaken your colony.
We're talking one specific type of mite. Is that right?
Correct.
What mite is that?
Varroa.
So the Varroa mite, and that is the principal vector for disease transmission in a honeybee hive. Now, I'm hearing about a new mite that's just entered into Wisconsin, or?
No. I just talked to, actually, Patrick Sizemore, the state bee inspector, and that one I don't think is in the United States yet. They're watching it very closely to make sure it doesn't get into our country.
Okay. So rumors of that being in Wisconsin is not true yet.
Right. Hopefully not.
Okay, good. That's very good news. I'm glad I brought that up. So overwintering, I mean, you hear sometimes the hive doesn't have enough honey.
Well,
I think that's probably the lowest cause.
That's why I brought that up.
Beekeepers keep 60 to 100 pounds of honey on their hive to feed the bees. We also put on, they call them candy boards, which are hardened sugar with some extra nutrients in there. But you may have plenty of food on there, but when you have weather temperature changes and it gets warm, the bees will break their cluster, and then you get this major drop in temperature, like down to zero, and they can't get back into that cluster, and that will kill them.
Mm-hmm.
Or they will not cluster back up anywhere near a food source, so then they'll starve to death.
So wild temperature swings can contribute to hive outs.
March has been considered the month of doom.
My wife continually reminds me of that. She says, if they get through March, they're going to live. Otherwise, March is the problem.
Yep.
You know, you might think it might be December, January, February. No, it's March.
It's March.
Yeah.
Bees are very clean. They clean themselves. They clean each other. They keep the hive as clean as they can. Bees will not poop in the hive. So bees have to leave the hive, do a quick swoop around, and get back in the hive. So sometimes it's just them being too stuck in the hive during the cold where they can't get out.
Huh.
And that affects their health as well.
Fascinating. I unfortunately had a bear come for first time in, you know, since I've been living there in Stoddard, 40 years, right?
Yes, we saw that. That was amazing.
This is a 300. The bear hunters that I know saw the print for the bear and how it was made in the dry dirt. They estimated the size of the bear was 275 to 300 pounds. Fortunately, the second day, after it had ripped our hives apart and we put them back together, since we're horse people, I've had enough fencers sitting around doing nothing. I erected a fencer around my hives, a healthy one, a one-jewel fencer. And the next night that bear came in, and we got him on the surveillance camera. And as you saw in the game camera video I showed you folks, the bear walked around the fencer, and that was an experienced bear because he didn't touch the fence.
Yeah, he'd been zapped before.
He'd been zapped before. We got pictures of that bear sitting down, patient, next to the box that had the 12-volt car battery in it, pawing at the box. And I was really, really worried that that bear was going to, you know, snag one of the leads off the fence, but he didn't. But he...
He knew where the source was.
I'm going to assume he did, because the zapper was right there, and he pawed at it, but he did not touch the fence. But the fencer... I put up a four-wire fence, that kept them away. So that was, for beekeepers out there, if you have problems with bears, get a one-jewel fencer. I've got a solar one now, or a car battery one now, if you can't get AC power out to your hives, that will keep them away. Four strands minimum, you know, so, yeah.
And contact the DNR, because they do have resources for you as well.
Right, and they'll probably steer you to your local game warden, and my local game warden called me, and he offered me different resources and assistance and talked to me about it. But he was correct. This was a lone bachelor who came into the area, found some food. Once I secured my food, he moved on. My only concern is, where did that bear move on to? I mean, right?
He's going to go. When's the next one coming?
Yeah, so we're leaving the zapper up. Every night we judiciously turn that zapper back on. We don't leave it running during the day just because I don't want my dogs to get into it. So, I have a question. Before I get to that, I want to offer a word of advice to our listeners. A lot of times, they'll get information off of the internet about beekeeping and trying to problem solve. I just want to make sure that when they get their information, to pay attention to where is the geographical location of the podcaster or the YouTuber. If they're in California or Texas or Georgia or any of those warm climate places, and they're offering advice on how they're miraculously or managing their hives, take that with a grain of salt. If they're not from our area, from our latitude, a lot of their advice will not be appropriate. So just pay attention to that. But having said that, let me get back to. I got to do a channel check. And I want to make sure that everyone knows that they are listening to Frank Dravis at WDRT Conversations, 91.9 FM in Viroqua. And my guests today are Becky Brockman and Linda Olson from the La Crosse Area Beekeepers. So there's this conundrum. I hear that the swarm season, particularly for this year, is starting May 1st. So what I don't understand is the hive has just come through winter. They've been stressed. I mean, March is only like, you know, from March to May 1st is only like about a month. How can a hive be ready to swarm in May? Because I hear this is when the start of the swarm season is. How can that happen or be?
Some of it depends on the strength of the hive that came through winter. And when you think about it, your queen is capable of laying somewhere around 2,000 eggs a day. So a worker bee hatches and is ready to work at 21 days. So you have 3 weeks. So potentially think about how fast that hive can grow. And then the other issue is, how big is their space? If they're very limited in their space, they're going to decide that it's time to, well, they call it maybe procreate. They're keeping the hive alive, and they're going to split, which part of the hive is going to stay at the original site, and part of it is going to go find a new site. And when they do that, that's when you'll see the swarms. The old queen, they chase her around the hive to thin her down, because your queen potentially will make her one maiden flight or virgin flight when she gets mated, and the other flight is potentially when they swarm, and they have to lighten her up so she can fly.
So for the novice or the regular person walking around outside in the summer, what does a swarm look like?
It's a big ball of bees.
It looks wonderful. It's just an awesome experience to see it. It is. It's a big football shape or bigger oval shape. The bees just in a pile.
And so it's a group of bees that have basically said, hey, we don't have enough room in our current hive. We're going to go find our new hive. And they've landed in a tree somewhere as a temporary staging area. Is that right?
So how it starts is that the queen sends out scout bees. The scout bees go in all directions looking for the right place to go to before they launch. They come back waggle dancing, and whichever one is the best waggle dancer, they will follow that one to where the next stop is. They don't get to their final stop generally in one fell swoop. Usually they'll stop and rest. By the time we go to catch them, they're already gone. And then when they do find the place that they want, they will settle, but it's because the scout bees checked it out first.
So if someone sees a swarm and they want to get rid of it, can they call us?
Absolutely. Sure. And that's one of our missions, is that that's why we have an open Facebook page. That's why we have my number listed with the La Crosse County Police, because we've gotten calls through them. I've got my number out at the pesticide places. So, for example, DeBoer Pest Control will not go out and kill bees without verifying with us first that they aren't honeybees. So you said the German bee looks a lot. That German hornet looks just like a honeybee, a little bit brighter colors, but they will burrow into places, and then people will call us, and it's generally send out the pesticide, because that's the only way we can deal with that. But if it's a honeybee, they won't go touch them.
Okay. When you catch a swarm, what do you do with the swarm?
Love it.
Well, I want to backtrack a little bit. The queen, being bigger as she is, the reason they stop periodically is to let her rest. And the other thing is, when the bees that have been determined to leave the hive, they load up on a lot of honey. So they're kind of on a sugar high, and they're a little more dopey. So they're not as aggressive as another bee might be. So they are slower.
You can actually pick them up with your hands. And to feel thousands of bees vibrating in your hand is just an experience that you'll never forget. So you pick them up, dump them in a box. Pick them up, dump them, look for the queen. The minute you find the queen, you get her in a clip. So you keep her where you can see her. You set her in that box, and all of the bees in that swarm will follow.
So, by the way, I've always been impressed by someone who says, look for the queen. That's way easier said than done. I just want to let you know. I know it's twice as big as a regular honeybee, but I've looked for queens, and if they weren't painted with a little dot, it would have been really hard for me to find it.
You know, once you start finding them, it becomes easier. It's kind of like all of a sudden the light clicks on. Some of them are very difficult to find.
You want to get better at it. There's a book out. It's cost $12. You can get it from Amazon or your local bookstore, but it's called Queen Spotting Handbook, and it actually is page by page of pages of bees with one queen in there somewhere, and then you turn the page and it shows you where she is. It's an amazing book, and more than one beekeeper has shared that idea.
Hmm. You know, you said earlier about pollinator gardens.
Mm-hmm.
What you said is exactly what our experience has been. My wife has got, I measured it, and she's got about 2,000 square feet of pollinator garden around the house. And our honeybee hives are about 150 feet from the house. Ever since we moved them close to the house, our success rate has gone way up. Our survival rate has gone way up because we were able to go out and look at the bees all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We can see when they're being robbed. We can see when they're bearding. We can see when they're swarming, right? If we have them out in the country, a distance from our house, we did that before, and we wouldn't visit them nearly as much, and we didn't know what was going on. So our success rate went way up. But at first I was trepidatious about having, you know, pick a number, 120,000 honeybees within 150 feet of my house. They never bother us. And when you said they don't go to the pollinator garden, I love standing in my wife's pollinator garden and watching all of the different pollinators in that garden, the myriad of them, from the tiny little green wasps to the big queen bumblebees. It's fascinating. But there'll be seldom will there be a honeybee, even though there's 120,000 of them about 50 feet away. Now, our bird bath is, I'd say, 200 feet away from the honeybee hives. That's a popular place for our honeybees. And to keep our honeybees from drowning in our big bird bath, we throw leaves in there, and the honeybees will land on the leaves that are floating in the water, and they'll drink the water, and they'll take off. And, you know, we'll watch the dance between the honeybees and the birds, and they share. It's like, it's very interesting. They take turns at the water. The German yellow jackets, though, they're quite a bit more feisty, but the honeybees and the birds, they get along. So that's kind of interesting to watch. We talked about pests. Beetles. Are beetles an issue for honeybees?
The small hive beetle is more unusual in our area. I know one of our members was talking about he had them, but they were more than likely transplanted from the south. They prefer the warmer weather.
So for pests, it's generally the predominant one is the viral mite.
The mites, yes.
Yeah. I will not get into how to detect viral mites or treat them.
That's another hour conversation.
I personally have had success treating them with the hop guard, which is actually, looks like it's like molasses on these strips. I've had success treating that. But
there is one new one for those listening who are beekeeping right now and wondering what treatments to use. There is a new one out. It's called Noroa, Norroa, and that's one that we talked to Patrick Swayze, the Wisconsin
Sizemore.
Patrick, we'd love to talk to Patrick Swayze. Patrick Sizemore about, and it is one of the, it's a different approach to mite
Steve's
control.
Not going to edit that out, by the way. He's going to leave that in.
I'll tell my husband not to listen. But it is a new one, and instead of attacking the mite, it attacks the mite's RNA, so it's getting into its makeup more so that it's not, and it's, as a mite lays eggs, it's not laying as many eggs. So
it prevents it from laying eggs.
Yeah.
And the bees carry it, put it in their food, and that's how it apparently gets dispersed into the hive. If you have a mite load, you want to get rid of that before you start using it. So you're going into it with a low load.
A mite load means you have a, there's a pop, there's a high population of mites in your hive.
Correct.
Right. For those of us, or for the new beekeepers, or maybe existing beekeepers who are maybe thinking about turning this into a side hustle or trying to make money off of it, I've got a quiz for you two. Multiple choice quiz. And it has to do with the economics of beekeeping. Okay, so here's your choices. And what I'd like you to do is answer from the most lucrative to the least lucrative. Here's your choices for making money in beekeeping. First choice is selling honey. Second choice is selling the wax, like candles. Third choice is selling queens. Fourth choice is constructing hive boxes and frames and selling those. Selling nukes, and which are the, we'll call them new hives, or shipping their hives off to California or Texas. Of those, which do you think is the most lucrative monetary thing for a beekeeper?
It totally depends on whether you're going to be a hobby beekeeper or are you going to be in, have an apiary.
That if you have the capability, queen rearing is a big one. Shipping hives to California, there's a lot of regulations that you have to go through. You do get some sort of monetary stipend, but I don't know that it maybe covers the cost of all the testing and things that you have to do to get them shipped. You know, honey is the biggest seller, but there's a lot of honey out there. Wax is a little more specific.
But very labor-intensive.
Labor-intensive. Raising the nukes, you've got to have your bees winter or have the sources, which you're also getting into the larger operations again for that. So, yeah, you're kind of dependent on the direction you're in. The queen rearing is also specialized. So for the average person, just having the bees, having the pollinators, and enjoying them is probably the biggest benefit of beekeeping.
So if you have, say, 2 to 5 hives, and 5 is a lot.
5 is a lot.
For a hobbyist, 5 is a lot. So 2 to 5 hives, maybe you sell some honey, right, to your neighbors. But there's a big jump or big step going from there to actually making some sort of profit where you're going to have to go from 5 to maybe 20 or more and to develop what you call an apiary where you have a strong collection of hives. Becky, you want to say something?
The thing you have to start with is, what's your mission? Why are you doing bees? Because I went into it because I wanted to save the bees. I wanted to help the bees. I never went into beekeeping to make money. And any money I make off honey is just a bonus.
You put back into the hive.
Exactly. Well, exactly. So I started because someone asked me if they could put a hive on my land. Yeah, they couldn't because they had covenants. They couldn't put it on their land. So I said, yeah, I've always been interested. So for 1 year, I got to just see it from afar. And that's then I dove into it. But I never set out to make money off honey or anything.
Mm-hmm. I know that when we're able to collect honey off of our hives, it's a great time, and it's a time of bounty, but there's been more than a few years where we haven't been able to take honey because we were worried about the bees overwintering.
And there are a group of people who will never take honey.
Yep.
They're not going to touch the honey because they don't feel like it's their reward.
So if we have listeners out there that want to get involved with the association with our group, what's the best way for them to do that?
I'll let Becky answer that. She's our communications person.
So we've set up the website, and on the website is obviously our email address, which is lsebeeks@gmail.com, lsebeeks@gmail.com. You can go on the website. You can message us through the website. We offer a class in the spring, and along with the class, it's a one-day class, but in addition to that, we mentor our students all the way through the summer. So we don't just tell you all about it and then say, go for it. It's really part of our mission to keep all the members talking. We always say 10 beekeepers, 12 different ideas. So there's a big group of sharing that happens, and I think that support is one of the biggest things that a beginning beekeeper is going to need. Because you can read every book, you can watch every video, but until you open that hive and look at 10,000 bees looking right back at you, you really need someone's at least mentoring to help you through all that.
And even doing everything correctly, the bees are going to do what the bees are going to do.
I like saying we're going to put up a high rise and maybe we can seed it with a nuke and then try and make life easy for them.
Right.
So with that, I'd like to thank you, Becky and Linda, for attending today's conversation. And I'd like to thank our listeners. Here we are. You've spent another hour with WDRT and me, Frank Dravis, your host. I hope you've enjoyed our time. And I want to thank my guests today, Becky Brockman and Linda Olson from the La Crosse Area Beekeepers. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Frank.
You're welcome.
Thank you.